All right, so we're back in Building 26, Windows World. Who are you?
I'm Gabe Hall. I'm the Group Program Manager for the Windows Performance Team. My team works on performance for Windows Server and Windows Client. Mm-hmm. I also have, for the past year, been working on a project called Velocity, which is primarily focused on taking some of the learning, the tools, the training, the telemetry that we've built for Windows, for core Windows, and bringing that out to the ecosystem. One of the things we found at Vista launch was that many of the ISVs, IHVs, and OEMs that we work with were having difficulty getting the best out of Windows in terms of reliability, performance, battery life is another thing my team works on. Security, of course, has been a big thing for Vista, and we continue to make progress there. But again, the OEMs and our partners often don't have the right set of tools or didn't have the right set of tools or data about how the ecosystem was doing as a whole in order to understand where to focus the energies and make improvements. So that's what the Velocity effort is primarily about. There also is a fairly focused effort on OEM systems and helping a specific set of systems that we partner with OEMs on do well on what we call the fundamentals. So fundamentals are app and device compatibility, performance, power, reliability, and that's it. I bundled the app and device compatibility as five. So the goal there was to work with our OEM partners and make sure that the systems that they're actually getting out to customers are as well optimized for Vista as possible. And what we've learned along the way there is that the tools that Microsoft has provided, we've needed some improvement on that. We've made some pretty significant headway, particularly around performance with the release of the Windows Performance Tools, which are in the SDK and on WHTC. And also in the sense of knowledge best practices. So battery life was a great example of that, where some of the initial feedback on Vista was that people were seeing battery life that was not equivalent to XP. And our expectation was actually that Vista battery life would exceed XP on the same systems because of the power management improvements we put in place, because of efficiency improvements in the core OS around power. So that was sort of a surprise to us. And what we found by investigating systems was that there were frequently a number of fairly small things that impact the battery life, but which had an additive effect. So we released this thing called the Battery Life Solutions Guide on WHTC. We call it the Battery Life Cookbook. And it's basically just a tool to sort of share all the knowledge that we have on what you want to do in order to build the best battery life system possible. For everything from fairly straightforward tips and tricks, mostly just tips, there's not really any tricks, all the way to help in analyzing and understanding performance problems and then using the tools that we have to sort of remediate those and get the best possible battery life. The effort working with the OEMs has also turned into an effort with IHVs and hardware vendors and software vendors because, of course, a big part of the system that an OEM provides is the software and drivers and hardware choices that they make. So when you take something like battery life, one of the biggest aspects of battery life, of getting long battery life, is what we call get idle, stay idle. The modern CPUs are very, very good at quickly cycling into deep P states and C states, power and CPU megahertz states, so they consume less power. And the CPU is typically the third highest consuming component in a notebook system for power. And so if you can get that thing into idle as quickly as possible and keep it as long as possible, it can greatly improve the overall battery life of the system. What happens often with software and hardware drivers is that the design decisions that are made in the building of those drivers and software can cause the CPU to constantly sort of blip in and out of these C states and deep C states and P states and sort of take the edge off of that possible improvement. A good example of that is things like background polling. We found that some software was doing a lot of background polling of the system. Things like changing the timer tick frequency of the system, which is something that we definitely sort of don't recommend unless you're doing a fairly media-intensive task and you need to have a high-resolution timer. So little things like this, when it's cumulative, when you're bundling dozens of drivers and dozens of applications on a system, These things can add up, and the net effect can be a pretty significant difference in battery life. So that's what the Battery Life Solutions Guide is about. It's about helping the OEMs and our other partners understand the impacts of those systems, or those decisions, and then how to measure that and design a system or a package that basically is optimized to get good battery life. Many of those same things for power are also true for performance. Things like background polling means that you're consuming CPU, but sort of more dangerously for performance is the consumption of disk I.O. The disk is by far the slowest component of the system, very frequently the bottleneck, because as I.O.s are serviced, it can block other I.O.s that are sort of waiting. So if you have a very chatty application or a driver that's doing a lot of particularly random I.O.s, random reads and random writes, those things can get in the way of random I.O.s from another application, which could be the foreground application that the user is actually accessing. So, you know, the advice that we're giving to software vendors and hardware vendors is really to focus a lot of energy on, you know, getting idle, staying idle, and improving that overall efficiency, especially when it's a background application. You know, things that are foreground apps, you know, the user, there's a reasonable expectation that the user is actively using that, and consuming CPU and I.O. is a fairly reasonable thing to do. Mm-hmm. When you have a sys tray application or a service, that's really where we really want to focus on getting sort of out of the way of the user activity. And that, for a software vendor or hardware vendor, means, you know, really thinking hard about the choices that they make in terms of the design of the application or the design of the driver to do periodic activity when the system is idle. We have an on-idle trigger for task schedulers, so you can actually get notifications when the user is not present at their system. Mm-hmm. Using low-priority I.O., which is a mechanism we put in place for Vista, it gets the foreground I.O. Priority so that that user application can actually get to the disk first. So these are things that we do in the OS as well for things like the search indexer. One of the big reasons that search indexing on Vista is so much better than on XP is that XP didn't have an I.O. priority mechanism. And so the indexer had to sort of be smart about figuring out when to use the disk and when not. And, you know, users are unpredictable. You never know when they're going to actually go do a disk-intensive task. And so getting out of the way was difficult. With low-priority I.O., it's sort of a no-brainer. You just set that, and the system manages that, and that foreground activity takes precedence, and the background activities sort of doesn't interfere. Mm-hmm. So those are great things for, you know, for people to take advantage of, you know, in the OS.
Excellent. So what are some of the things you're seeing? Vista's been out now for a couple of years. What are some of the key problem areas that you've seen with IHVs and ISVs or whatever Vs you want to call it?
Sure.
So what are developers doing wrong, for the most part, that you're seeing, like the most common mistakes?
Yeah, I would hesitate to call them mistakes, because okay. A mistake implies that there was something that they did incorrectly. Mm-hmm. And I think that really what we're seeing is that driver vendors and software vendors are mostly trying to do the right thing by their application or their driver, and not always thinking about how that is run in the context of the overall system. You look at the typical notebook today, and it's got something like 100 devices, you know, 70 to 100 devices that are, you know, if you go look at Device Manager, that list is quite long. Mm. So you've got a driver for every one of those, sometimes multiple drivers because you have a class driver and a specific driver. And you look at the typical OEM, just the system as they're shipped from an OEM, and they might have a dozen applications pre-installed on a system. And then, of course, you know, the common things that a user is going to go actively install themselves, which can also get in the way. So it's really about the mix of things and the overall the context of the system. And the only way that really, you know, we can ensure a good customer experience at the end of that is if each party that's involved in that process really thinks hard about their efficiency and how to stay out of the way. And operate in the right context for the user. You know, obviously, we're not evangelizing that a 3D game, fully immersive game, should use low-priority I.O. mechanisms or get out of the way of the user. The user is really actively interacting with that. But what we want is that when the game is being played, everything else in the system saying, gosh, this is a foreground application going on here. It's very intense, resource-intensive. Now is a great time to back off. Mm-hmm. So what... It's not so much a mistake as much as You know, if we all think about that in that context and ensure that as we write our applications, drivers, and even, you know, some of the design of the hardware itself for the, you know, for the OEMs and ODMs, that if we focus on that, you know, that sort of chaotic end state as the reality of the world, then, you know, we can start making smart choices around how to be efficient and keep from interfering with the end user experience.
That's interesting, because when you think about it, and you know, an operating system sort of, when I'm writing an application that runs on an OS, often I'm not really thinking in the context of an OS. I'm thinking of it in the context of the problem I have to solve. And so that, I mean, in a sense, it's changing the way people think about, if I'm writing a device driver, for example, for a piece of hardware, I'm thinking about how to get that to work the best it possibly can. And it doesn't seem that it's normal for people to think about, okay, this is one little player on a large system that can have impact that could, you know, hurt the general user experience of the person way up there in user mode.
Yeah.
So how do you, I mean, it's an interesting problem.
It is. And you know, I'll give you a great example, you know, without being specific. One thing that we encountered was a printer driver's UI component, the user mode UI component for a printer driver, was doing a cyclical background WMI query. So it was every few hundred milliseconds polling to see if a new printer had been put in. And for the printer vendor, like you said, they were trying to solve a particular problem where they wanted to have a nice user experience so that when that thing plugged in, it immediately popped up and said, "Hey, I see your new printer, and here's all the things that I can offer you for this printer." And again, you know, from that viewpoint, they're trying to offer a value to the customer, which is a great thing. Mm-hmm. The downside is that by doing that, they were consuming a pretty significant percentage of CPU cycles, which had two effects. One is that other things on the system were sort of having to fight for CPU, but then also, like I said earlier, the CPU the processor states. It was not able to sort of cycle down into the deep C states and P states to consume less power and to be in a more efficient mode, because it was constantly having to service this WMI query. And of course, the WMI query itself could take, you know, 150 milliseconds. So, you know, it meant that it was just basically constantly dealing with this query. And again, the vendor was trying to provide a rich experience for the customer. But and if that was the only thing that system did, it was very good at it. It was very efficient. It didn't really need much more than, you know, 20% CPU in order to offer that rich experience. But, you know, the user is trying to do other things, and that CPU activity then can interfere with that. So yeah, it is really about sort of thinking in the you know, the global context about how to be efficient and get out of the way. Some of the things that we're doing to try to help with that, we released the Windows Performance Tools, which, you know, for about a decade has been sort of secret sauce for Windows. It was designed by the performance team for our use in deep debugging of Windows itself. It relies on the ETW infrastructure, which has only really been documented publicly for a while, you know, for a couple Windows releases. But the capability that it offers in order to really understand how all of the components, all the resources of the system work together, is something that really no other debugging tool has been able to do. With the XPerf tool, for example, you can really overlay CPU activity, disk activity. You can drill into the stacks of the processes that are active and understand what functions are taking the most amount of CPU, they're taking the most amount of disk, and sort of go work through that system state. And how your application is used in context of that. The nice thing about it is that the ETW tracing, because it's just basically integral to Windows, means you can turn tracing on, you can use your application or your driver, or run the experience that you're trying to measure, capture that trace, and then go analyze it in XPerf, and it gives you this nice time layout of how everything is being used over time. And it's a great tool for really understanding what your efficiency looks like. The recommendation from Microsoft is that a well-optimized system over a 15-minute idle period has an average of no more than 2% CPU utilization over that period. Mm. So background tasks that are constantly kicking in and doing work are gonna up that rate, you know, considerably. And every, you know, I don't think there's any magic formula that we figured out, but every percentage point that goes up means a commensurate decrease in battery life and also a greater chance of a background application or background process interfering with a foreground process. Mm-hmm. So we've got this tool that's out there. It's a very general purpose analysis and debugging tool. So we're also sort of cognizant of that, and we've started releasing what we call quick start guides that are focused really on analyzing a specific set of experiences, so that you can sort of see how your thing impacts that experience. The first one that we released is the on-off quick start guide, mm-hmm. Which is for boot, shutdown, standby, resume, hibernate, in and out. And we also have a tool called XBoot Manager that basically sort of scripts that operation so that they don't have to sort of do the complexity of getting tracing set up and then shut the machine down. They can just basically use XBoot Manager to deal with it for them and handle it. And then they get a boot trace or a resume trace. And, you know, in those you can see, a driver's impact on boot times, total boot times. You can see an application's impact on what we call a post-boot period. So there's a point from when the Explorer becomes, we call it Explorer desktop ready. Mm-hmm. So you can start clicking on things, basically, is what that means. The system is still doing stuff. You're loading your startup apps and services are finishing initializing and things like that. But you can, the user can take action. So from that stage until the point where the system sort of settles back down, all the apps are loaded, the gadgets are loaded, and everything's working, then that's what we call the post-boot period. And so you can trace that post-boot period and see what's happening there. And, you know, boot and the on-off paths are particularly tricky for, you know, for that sort of the collision of applications, simply because everybody's sort of waking up and doing their initialization and wanting to consume resources. And so, you know, our request to developers is they think about things that they're going to do in these critical time paths, because, you know, some of the biggest feedback we hear around performance from customers is really these on-off transition paths. Sure. Boot is important, right? Resume Absolutely. From standby is important to people. Really we're asking people to really look at that, how they're doing work in those paths, and you know, have back-off logic. Think about things that can be deferred. Or think about things that they can do more efficiently, building caches that are maintained across boots, you know, mm-hmm. or across resume states. One of the big things we're seeing in resume is that you'll notice that if you, on a fairly loaded system, a lot of apps, a lot of drivers, you know, typical system, if you standby and then immediately resume, just, you know, a few seconds or a minute later, the system will sort of feel snappy and awake, fairly quickly, or should. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you sleep the system and go away for a couple hours, you know, overnight, mm-hmm. wake it back up, it sort of feels like it's like, you know, staggering awake in some ways. Mm-hmm. One of the things that causes that is that every application that's alive when the system goes into a sleep state, if they're setting timers that are set to expire in, you know, 30 seconds and wake the app up and do something else, then, you know, that period's going to have elapsed. If you've left it overnight, you wake it up, and pretty much everything's going to say, okay, my timer event has fired. I need to wake up and do some work right now. And if everybody's doing that all at the same time, that means there's high resource contention for CPU, for memory, and most critically for disk.
Sure.
Because, like you said, the disk is the biggest bottleneck. One of the things that a lot of people don't realize when it comes to performance is that modern CPUs are just wickedly fast. I mean, you know, we can do, you know, operations with CPUs that we couldn't even dream of 10 years ago. And that in a typical user session, if you look at how you maybe not developers, because we tend to be a little bit more intensive than others, but a typical office worker, if you take an hour period of their activity, about 80 to 90% of the time that they're sitting there working, their CPU is basically idle, because you have bursts of activity that are high CPU and it settles back down. This is a system that doesn't have some background task that's going out of control.
Sure.
But most of the time it's idle. It's because CPUs are so powerful. Memory also, you know, incredibly fast, getting bigger and bigger. We're glad to see that. But the disks still have this penalty when it comes to random I/O. Most disks are very fast at sequential operations. They can stream in a lot of, you know, reads or out a lot of writes fairly quickly. But the penalty for the head moving with every seek for random IOs means that if you try to pull in a megabyte or more of random IO, you figure there's a 10 to 12 millisecond seek penalty on every 4K read. That means it's going to take a second, 2 seconds possibly to pull in a megabyte of data. Whereas on a sequential read, where you're getting 70, 80, 90 megabytes per second sequential read rate, that's milliseconds. It's incredibly fast. So that's so important to minimize the amount of random I/O that happens on a system for that reason, because those things can significantly affect the user experience. If you have a lot of random writes and you're trying to do random reads at the same time, those things can trip up on each other, and you can wind up with a read that's bottlenecked behind 50, 60, 100,000 other random IOs. That 10 milliseconds adds up quickly, and it turns into a second or a couple 2 seconds waiting in the main thread of some UI application that the user is waiting to launch. Sure. So that's critical to manage that IO effectively. Mm-hmm. Again, things like low priority IO was a big mechanism we put in Vista, but also Superfetch, right? Superfetch and ReadyBoost were really designed to help with that problem by minimizing the need of applications to go to disk by proactively caching data, predictably based on prior activity. So, if you have an application where you might have to page in a settings file or a user file or binaries for the app itself, if those things are already sitting in memory waiting for you, then you don't have to worry about going to disk for them. And that means less I/O in the system at the critical path. ReadyBoost is basically just expands the size of the cache you have available, and because it's solid state, there's that seek penalty is more on the order of 800 microseconds or a millisecond versus 10 to 12 milliseconds. So, and certainly some of the new SSDs that we're seeing are getting that same kind of performance. So there's less, much less of a seek penalty. There's really no such thing as a seek. It's all sort of random addressing.
Yeah.
But that random I/O penalty really isn't there, and so we can see some pretty nice performance numbers on SSDs. Although some of the first generation ones did have some challenges with a lot of I/O streaming I/O in terms of mini random writes, mini random reads, kind of intermixed together, mm-hmm. Just because of the wear leveling policies and other things that are specific to the SSD.
So are you seeing an uptake of the sort of hybrid hard drive models where you'd have a disk and an SSD, solid
state?
Well,
so I'm not sure that I've seen anything that has an SSD, standalone SSD, and a standalone disk. Hmm. But certainly there are the ready drive hybrid hard drives that have a conventional hard drive with a flash cache in them that's a write cache. Those are really more tailored around power reduction and reliability than performance per se. Mm-hmm. The fact that it's a write cache means you don't get that sort of that read cache capability that you have with ReadyBoost. But what it does mean is that you can write into that cache without spinning up the disk. Spinning up the disk not only has a potential performance penalty to it, but also a power penalty. It takes power to spin that up, you get the inertia going and sustain it. So if we can spin the disk down, we can save energy. And for a laptop, that can be significant. The disk is about 10 to 12% of power budget on average. So if we can keep that disk spun down 90% of the time, then that's a few percent here and there, and that adds up. I mean, honestly, a few percent can add up to 30 minutes if you've got a 60 watt hour battery. If you're saving a watt, That's a pretty good savings.
Absolutely. And it also has green implications, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, computers use power. So what about you? This is, you got some excellent movies that you are a fan of, clearly. And it looks like you've been here for a long time, given when you were given your five-year anniversary back in, 1997 or 95?
If you notice, I have 3 5-year anniversary clocks. what I like to tell people is I did 15 years of work in my first 5 years here. It's a much longer story, actually.
I believe
but,
it.
But yeah, no, I started in 92, uh-huh. And my 16-year anniversary is actually just last week.
Congratulations, man.
I hope to be here for 16 more years.
Excellent.
Or more. I started in product support. I worked in test. I've been program manager for about a dozen years now, and I've sort of always been focused on quality. Mm. It's always been sort of my personal mission in life. I worked in retail software at Egghead Software when they still existed, which is how I got hooked up with Microsoft. But one of the things that like always frustrated me, you know, working retail was having to deal with customers who are having a hard time with, you know, some software, some piece of hardware, and you know, and the quality problems that they face. And of course, coming to product support, you know, that's all you do all day is deal with, you know, people that are having a hard time, having, you know, encountering quality problems or finding things too difficult for them to problems for them to solve. So that really led me to working in the Windows group and worked on sustained engineering. I was lucky enough to be one of the first people to invent the telemetry systems that we have, the Windows Error Reporting and OCA.
Nice.
And that was again same mission was, you know, I wanted to hear directly from people, directly, you know, with as high a degree of accuracy as possible, the problems that they're encountering, so we can go fix that.
And
it's great. I'm really proud of that, and very happy to see the kinds of problems that we've been able to find and fix with telemetry. That, you know, A, might have gone unresolved in the past before we had this capability, and B, allows us to understand with, you know, great certainty what is affecting the most people in the most significant way, and so we can really laser focus our attention on those, both for Microsoft code and for third-party code. So we also have this the developer portal for accessing the telemetry data that we collect. So people can go out today and see the blue screens and app crashes. And
caused by their code.
That's right.
You know, I just had Vince Argovan on.
Yes, Vince was my partner in crime in the first days of OCA when we were tackling the blue screen problem. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So what are the blue screens like been for Vista? I mean, here, let's report card.
You know, honestly, Vince is the right guy to talk about that. I don't know. I know that, that you know, again, we have much greater visibility to the sets of problems. And we've been, I certainly, you know, when I talk to Vince, hear all kinds of great news about things that are getting fixed and
sure.
And the kinds of improvements that we're seeing in the ecosystem. We do a pretty regular sit down of all of the quality focused people and look at the telemetry data we have. We actually also have boot and shutdown and resume time telemetry data for Vista. And we look at the trends there and dig into the problems and find the issues that are most significantly impacting customers. And you know, in general, what we're seeing is a great improvement overall in the ecosystem. As Microsoft's code quality improves, Windows with Service Pack 1 was a pretty significant improvement in a lot of things. Particularly for my side of the world, for performance, we had a lot of really great performance fixes in there. For reliability, the numbers are looking good. We have this saying of lather, rinse, repeat. Mm-hmm. With the telemetry stuff when we started, that this notion of sort of continuous improvement that we can measure the ecosystem, find out what the pain points are, take that back, address the most critical ones, get those out there, and then we can measure again. So it's just this constant cycle of understanding what the pain points are and driving them down. And of course, the challenge for us is that it's not a static ecosystem,
sure.
Right? That we see something like 10,000 new P&P IDs for devices every month.
Wow.
So don't quote me on that number. Vince would know better than I do.
But it's a
big number.
Sure.
You know, and you look at the number of unique applications that are coming out in the world. I mean, you know, we have this millions of software and driver developers out there, you know, actively doing great work. So mm-hmm. You know, that ecosystem is changing constantly. And again, you know, there's this cumulative effect that sometimes, in fact, we see this quite often, where you know, an individual vendor may make a change, may release some software that on its own has, you know, has good quality, but when coupled with other factors in the system, the specific hardware or the specific configuration that the user has chosen, can encounter problems. And that vendor may not have, you know, any awareness of that. And, you know, and so we definitely are trying to build the right systems to put in place to measure those things and then drive that back actively, you know, to the software and hardware development community. To get those things addressed, and I think that we're seeing some really great work from the you know, our partners in the world, and I'm happy to say that, you know, Vista today is I think as good or better than XP ever was. So.
Outstanding. So let me ask you a question about not specific about the future versions of Windows, since we can't really talk about that for obvious reasons. But what are some of the big problems you're facing? I mean, let's look at it. It's a distributed world. It's becoming more and more distributed. Computation is going to be distributed across n number of servers in the cloud. And so from a user's user experience perspective, I could be running a client application, not a web page, a client application that's relying on computation happening thousands of miles away on distributed machines. Yet my experience could be, wow, the performance of Vista is terrible, right? Because I clicked on this, and what the hell is going on? So that's going to be an added dimension of complexity for people like you to figure out how to, you know, provide guidance or even track down where the bugs are happening. Because, I mean, distributed debugging is not fun.
Yeah.
So are you thinking about those kind of problems?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of the big things that we have been really thinking about in this hypothetical future release of Windows that we can't talk about.
Sure.
This notion of, you mentioned the weighting that is being done in a particular piece of UI on other resources that are that may be used by something else or in the cloud and we don't have any control over, but the user experience is potentially impacted by that. So one big thing that we really drove hard in the early sort of engineering planning phase was this notion of interaction classes. There's some really stellar work done by researchers in the developer division and around the company that we partner with on defining guidance around the kinds of user experience that we are going to expose to people and how long this should take and what the boundaries are and what the fallbacks are in case that user experience isn't tightly controlled within that interaction class. Break it down more practically because that's fairly high level. It takes clicking on the start menu.
Sure.
That's what we call an instantaneous interaction class. It's never acceptable under any circumstances for the start menu, when I click on it, not to pop up within a few hundred milliseconds. Mm-hmm. It's the user has an expectation that's an instant operation. Copying a file off of a network share is not an instant operation, as much as we'd like it to be. It takes time in order to do that. And so the difference in those kinds of operations are that an instantaneous operation needs to happen between 100 and 300 milliseconds, whereas an extended operation, which is what we think of when about a file copy, it can take longer, but there are things that contracts that we have with the user around that. There has to be cancellation. Right, there has to be the user for the opportunity for the user to cancel if they don't want to wait. It has to be task switchable, so I can move away to something else and leave that running in the background. So we really aggressively drove this concept around the company. It's a company wide thing, so that as each group designs their UI, they can do two things. One, they can put in instrumentation and measurements in place in the software to see how often, if they are, they're going beyond these boundaries. And then if they find that they are, if they're designing an experience that is susceptible to that, things like a network file copy, you wouldn't expect that to be instantaneous, so you shouldn't design the UI to be instantaneous. Of course, they didn't. There's a cancellation. But in any case where we saw a rough edge like that, we went aggressively, changing it so that something that could be long running then has a cancellation, has the ability for the user to switch away, and can continue in the background. And we also have guidelines around how much resources they can consume in the background as they do these things. Mm-hmm. So there's also a great book that was written by Steve Siao, who is one of the primary researchers that's available. It's called Designing and Engineering Time. And nice. So if you want some secret sauce about how Windows is designing our UI, there you go. So this is something we're definitely thinking about. And you can think about this in a lot of different levels. One, there's the sort of the maintaining a good user experience and designing for that. The second is, of course, all the technology layers that we need to go and put in place in order to allow for those operations to be as fast as possible, to be as consistent as possible, and to ensure that that the code is in place, the capability is in place to support that great user experience. Those things, of course, we can't talk about yet.
Of course not. That's interesting. And as I've talked about with Vince, and some would argue that there's the architectural flaw in Windows with the single-threaded apartment UI thread that you get to program against as a developer, which oftentimes can lead to, Office has problems with it to this day. They've gotten a lot better. But I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. You're not going to change the architecture. Let's talk a little about that.
Sure. I think there's a meta problem that we have to address when it comes to the change in the computing power. I mean, you know, we've been following Moore's Law for a long time. Processors are getting bigger, faster, 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 hotter, faster, faster. And now, of course, you know, we're reaching the boundaries of that, and, of course, all the CPU vendors are switching to multi-core. Well, multi-core, in order to get good benefit from that, needs multi-threading. And so there are certain tasks that are inherently good for multi-threading. A lot of server operations where you're doing concurrent connections, serving the same kinds of content concurrently to 10,000 or 100,000 users, you know, or more, that is a good multi-threading experience for multi-threading, a good scenario for multi-threading. UI, though, often is not, right? You know, if I want to open, you know, Notepad, I don't need 10 threads to open Notepad, right? I'm doing typically sequential operations. I'm building my window. I'm painting the contents. I'm, you know, maybe accessing my MRU list and things like that. But it won't inherently be advantaged by multi-threading. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think one of the challenges that developers around the world are facing right now is how do I take advantage of this different kind of computing power that I have in the operating system? Mm-hmm. And it comes back to that efficiency conversation we had before, right? Mm-hmm. One of the side effects of Moore's Law is that everyone sort of, you know, built assuming that there'd be this constant growth in headroom, and if my application is kind of, you know, pushing the envelope a little bit today, well, next generation processors are going to give me plenty of headroom and my app will run fast. And that's not necessarily true anymore. And so, we have to focus on that efficiency. You know, I think that it is something that Microsoft is, you know, both required to solve and is actively working on.
Absolutely.
To make that make it clear to developers how they can best take advantage of multi-core systems and multi-thread their applications as best as possible. There's some great things that are coming out. On that, but also how to use that capability in the OS such that the apps have more headroom to operate inherently, or that some of the things that they could do for multi-threading are that advantage is given to them automatically, right? So that I don't have to go and design for this, but that the OS exposes these capabilities to me in a seamless way. So that's definitely very top of mind for us. I mean, you know, with Windows, it's always a constant challenge as the landscape evolves with hardware, which, you know, often evolves at a different pace than software. You know, we have to stay ahead of that. We have to ensure that we have good support for those hardware innovations. It's one of the other things that this would really amazing to see with the telemetry data and with just the advances in the PC industry. You know, there's no one-size-fits-all computer anymore. I mean, you know, if there ever was, it was, you know, 10, 15 years ago when everything was a beige box, and if you had a laptop, it was a beige box in your lap. Now, you know, we have everything from these, you know, the incredibly small, fairly low-powered PCs up to, you know, incredibly high-powered gaming rigs, and Windows really needs to work well across all of those. And so it's a huge challenge for us to do so. And, you know, and it really requires, for us to deliver on that, it requires a really rich understanding of and partnership with the hardware and software ecosystem so that we can help, you know, the right design choices be made by the OEMs, help them optimize on the low end, help them take advantage of capabilities on the high end. And there's always this, you know, this sort of, with the jump in notebooks versus desktop as sort of the primary computing experience, you know, there's an additional dimension of balancing that has to happen. How do I balance the great performance that I want with great power efficiency so that I don't have to lug around my, you know, my AC brick with me wherever I go? So, you know, and that's not always something that's really transparent to users, that, you know, they don't necessarily understand right out of the gate that doing something like watching a DVD is a significant impact on the system in terms of power. There's a lot of stuff going on there, a lot of computation. You're reading the optical drive, you're displaying, you know, really, you know, keeping the GPU active. So that's very different than sitting reading a web page, you know, in IE, where things can kind of sort of settle down and go into a quiet state.
Absolutely.
So, moreover, we don't really want them to have to worry about that. We want to make sure that there's right. Yeah, they shouldn't have to worry about that. It should just work. So we are doing a lot to try to balance the way the system uses power, provide some really very cool capabilities in terms of automatic power management, and doing a lot with the industry to take advantage of that. Great, you know, obviously some great partnerships with silicon vendors and hardware vendors in that space.
That's great. And just one last thing. You guys, I remember you've done interviews on this in Channel 9, and I'll link back to them, but you've done great work, at least you know for the IHV community, with the kernel mode driver framework and the user mode driver framework. A lot of good stuff in there that really helps developers write good code by default. The other question I would ask, I mean, that was a statement, not a question, but in terms of, you know, you have guidance, but then there's also have static analysis tools. You also have a system that can say, that can actually automatically detect that this thing's using too much I/O, or it's reading too much, writing too much, which is obviously a hard problem, or using too much processor. Tone it down, you know, relax it, or like automatic sort of a homeostatic system that, you know, parts of the system are going crazy and this other system balances it and negative feedback. So in that insanity, what I'm asking is you guys must be doing work for automatic, beyond guidance, beyond tools, sort of a system that can monitor bad code or code that's not bad but that's doing things it shouldn't do and then figure out how to handle it on its own.
So yes, yes, of course.
Blade Runner.
There's some very interesting and exciting things that are happening in terms of keeping the performance of the system, the power management system, consistent. You know, and dealing with the complexities that you call out. Mm-hmm. Personally, I feel like that it all starts with the originators of the code.
Right? Sure.
The best opportunity you have to ensure high quality is with the person sitting at a desk coding. Because the more we can help that person with knowledge, with tools, the better off I think the end product is going to be. And frankly, it's just from my experience in the industry, when I talk to developers one-on-one, there's not a single developer I've ever met who says, yeah, I don't care if my quality is bad. They take incredible pride in this stuff. So, you know, I think that empowering them with great tools, great training, great, you know, information is going to be the best way to reap the biggest results. And then from there, I think that you know, we do have to think about how to prevent the accidental mistakes, the things that run amok, you know, that inappropriately, and also dealing with, you know, the again, the context of the system where all of these great, well-meaning people make choices that, when you know, assembled into an OEM system, you know, out of the door or into a system that a consumer is going to download all kinds of applications on, when that happens, mm-hmm. that the developer made wise choices early on to sort of understand that, to back off appropriately, to think about efficiency, and to really think about that end state. One of the things that I think that, you know, that I'm making over generalization, certainly it's true of myself, it's easy for, you know, people that are very very technical, mm-hmm. to really deal with problems, because they, you know, wiping a system and reloading and tuning and trimming, and these are things that, you know, most of us are very comfortable with, but an end consumer who just wants their system to work, those people don't necessarily have the time, the patience, the education, you know, around the problems to know how to do that and to want to, and nor should they, right? So, yeah. So I think that it's easy for us to think about, you know, solving a problem in a very technical way. It's much harder to think about how do we do this in an automatic fashion. And it goes to the point you're asking, like, how do I tune against this sort of chaos that I can't predict? If you think about the combinatorics of the number of drivers, devices out there, the number of drivers available for those devices, because there's, you know, tons of versions that we have to deal with, the number of applications that, you know, the user can possibly run, you know, you're dealing with trillions of possible combinations. Mm-hmm. And you know, the only way, again, that I think you can sort of make that that chaos sort of work in the end is to first start off with the right guiding principles around, you know, wanting that quality to be there and really focusing energy on it, and then, you know, systematically sort of thinking through those problems. How do I prevent this thing from getting out of control and taking too many system resources at a critical time? And you know, I think that what Microsoft's really trying to do is to try to help people understand what those critical times are and how to think about solving the problem and gaining that efficiency during those critical times, so that you know if everybody's sort of backing off and working together harmoniously, then you know you can get the best possible result.
Outstanding. Well, hey, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
A great note to end on. And congratulations for 16 years.
Thanks.
Excellent work.
Thank you.
Cheers.